Blog Talk Radio.
Aloha and welcome to Talking Pictures, first episode of 2016. As always, it is wonderful to be here. This is our first episode since back in November when we interviewed Marcus Mizell, director of Actors for Hire, which is released now on iTunes, Google Play, Apple TV, all that good stuff. Check it out. Go into our archives, but not yet, because we have a great show planned for you here tonight. It is January the 3rd, and I'm just so happy to be here because this is a new year, and we had a wonderful 2015 with Talking Pictures. We had great guests, great just everything. So to come on tonight to be able to talk about Paul Newman, to be joined by our co-producer, Jim McNulty, is so awesome to me. One sec, I'm going to take a sip of my tea. Jim has been watching movies, for those of you that haven't caught any of our episodes where we break down a director or a genre of films or anything that film, has been watching movies for 55 years. And he just brings such a unique viewpoint to that. I'm sorry. I am just so jazzed to be here. Let me say cheers again to you and Happy New Year's to everyone. Paul Newman is an interesting topic for tonight because what a diverse career. What an influence. What a force of nature. What a wonderful, brilliant, genius actor he is. You can watch old films of Paul Newman and see the influence he had on other actors. And right now, I'm going to introduce, we are joined by our podcast producer,
Jim McNulty.
Thank you for joining us, Jim. As always, for those of you, don't do it yet, but if you enjoy tonight's episode, you can go into the archives. Jim and I have discussed the films of Gus Van Sant, Milos Forman. We've discussed remakes. We will have tons of stuff planned for you as we do format this like a show that we both love, Siskel and Ebert. Jim, first of all, Happy New Year to you. I've already said Happy New Year to your, to our guests. So toast to you.
Well, I'd like to say happy holidays to everyone and hope they have such a good new year that they surprise themselves.
What a great way of putting it. If you're listening to this show, your year's already started off right. No, we're not that into ourselves. Well, to start off with Paul Newman, I'm going to get into a little bit of trivia here. Newman, first of all, beyond just being, has, I've heard, I'm not old enough to say younger people, but I've heard people with less years than me say the salad dressing guy. Newman, yeah. Newman, wouldn't you say he's almost kind of like an example of how people should live? I mean, he was always doing his best. He was always giving back, kept his ego in check. He's a born January 26, 1925, passed away September 26, 2008, 83 years old. He's from Cleveland, Ohio. All due respect, surprises me he's as kind as he is if he's from Cleveland. And again, no offense, but my experience with Cleveland was not somebody who would just give millions and billions to charity. Jim, we're looking at an actor here that we're going to get into his films real quick, but what I wanted to mention to start out, because we always love throwing out that trivia, is we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 Oscar nominations before he's given an honorary award in 86. And then he wins in 87, which is technically for the films of 86. So don't get that confused with Michael Douglas's win. Color of Money, we'll get into that. And then he wins another honorary Oscar, the Humanitarian Award. And then he has two more Oscar nominations within the last 5 years before he passes on. Those of you, yeah. So, Jim,
amazing.
Growing up for you, if you could just explain before we jump into his films, I mean, what does Paul Newman mean to you? Has you, in a sense, pretty much grew up with his films?
Well, going back, since I was around for, you know, The Hustler and some of those things when they first came out, and in retrospect, looking back, at the time, I don't think I had enough life experience, enough understanding to actually get the real impact, what his earlier movies were really about. I just took them for what was up on the screen and didn't think any deeper than that. Now that I'm a bit older, I can see that the surface film always had with him in those days a deeper meaning. And that's what I was missing from, you know, when I first saw those movies. The guy really did have an ability to end up in movies that have stood the test of time. And I know that's real prosaic, but they have. What surprised me is just, you know, going over some stuff about him, looking it up in his life and career, is just how many movies he did. I mean, it's an incredible amount of movies, very diverse. Paul, do you know how many films he did altogether in his career?
I remember when I counted once, it was something like 55 or 52 or something.
Yeah, you know, that's amazing. I had no idea.
Especially given that he got his break in 54 with The Silver Chalice, which I'm sure you've heard that old story, Jim, where Newman hated his performance so much that to this day, he's the only actor who's taken out an ad in The Hollywood Reporter asking people to not watch his film.
Yeah, see, now that's one of the movies I saw. And at the time, there was no deeper meaning there, you know, for his character and the whole thing, or the movie, actually. And I could see how he was embarrassed. At the time, it was a movie that, you know, that carried me along.
Right. You know, well, I've never seen it because it's so elusive, and it's so, Paul Newman has given it so much bad press that I think that's why places don't carry it.
Too bad for Paul, because I already saw it. The cat's out of the bag.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, he talks about it in so many interviews, documentaries. We're not going to go into it tonight, because, like we said, there's just too much Paul Newman. But in the years between The Silver Chalice of 54 and 58, which I think 58 probably has to be his busiest year, he made 5 films. 3 of them are very well known. 1 is fairly known, but he made Long Hot Summer, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, The Left-Handed Gun, which he played Billy the Kid, and Rally Round the Flag Boys. Jim, Billy the Kid, for me, I just thought of Paul Newman because the other night I watched Young Guns 1 and 2, and they sure were a hoot. I mean, they weren't serious Howard Hawks westerns, but that I really enjoyed them. And Emilio Estevez had a lot of Paul Newman mannerisms, so I could tell where he had to have watched The Left-Handed Gun. It was really interesting. And then of course he's, you know, one of his known films in 1960 before The Hustler is Exodus, which I believe is Otto Preminger, which that's a whole nother podcast unto itself. Preminger is known for Anatomy of a Murder with Jimmy Stewart and one of the real subversive groundbreakers in film. But Jim, I would like, because this is still a great point of view, regardless of what it is. Again, anybody who's listening for the first time, this show celebrates that any point of view is a valid point of view. So join in the fun. Soon we're going to be inviting you guys to submit us films to review and discuss. So with that, Jim, let's kick this off with The Hustler.
The Hustler, okay. Yeah, like I said, though, these movies, The Hustler, I only saw them on a certain level. I didn't get them with what they were talking about, really. And it was still something that, you know, kept my attention. And at the same time, it was, I found it, as, you know, a younger person at the time, a little bit dry. And I know that's probably going to upset some people, but I was younger. And I didn't have, as far as I'm concerned, enough understanding of life to really get what was going on. To me, it was, you know, it was art for art's sake. It was entertainment.
Oh,
and,
yeah,
you know.
Oh, no, sorry, go ahead. Just moving something.
Yeah, no, it was just entertainment. And that's not to say anything negative. I don't, that's not negative. Because entertainment has gotten me through so many, you know, patches in my life. It's just that it's seeing, like you said, I think at the beginning, how, you know, the effect movies have on people, and sharing that and seeing them at different times, a repeat of a movie 10 years later. And that's something that you can do with Newman, because he just, he was a workhorse. He did what he did. He did it well. And he didn't do it with a lot of fanfare. He wasn't, you know, like all over the, aside from his looks, which were, you know, definitely taken into consideration by the media and, you know, the different magazines at the time. Aside from that, he didn't push for a lot more. And I know this is going into background and the whole bit, but I just really, you know, want to acknowledge that part of him. Because I think that part of him is, you know, is in what he does. And it was reflected in his life.
Well, he is known, he is known as one of the most modest people to ever be in Hollywood, along with the likes of Jack Lemmon, that old school generation that understood and got the fact that, pardon me one sec while I sip my tea.
Okay.
Our sound editor is going to love us. But basically, that old school thought of you do help the next generation, because who's going to do it when you're gone? Newman got that, understood it, was always complimenting younger actors that he worked with. In fact, just to be barely off subject, as I'd say what I think of The Hustler, Newman, as you know, started the charity. And those of you that don't know, you see his salad dressing and his popcorn and all that stuff at the store. He's made over $330 million to this day, and not one dime has went anywhere but charity. So that tells you what kind of person he is.
To get back to The Hustler a bit, though, Paul, I'm sorry to interrupt you. There was, with his acting in that, there's this subtle detachment. I mean, he's totally into the character, and there's this undertone of, you know, of humor. But there's just this sort of pulled backness to The Hustler, which I think also, you know, shows up in other stuff he does. It's just there. And
well, he's
appreciated.
He's beyond charismatic in Butch and Sundance, which we'll get into. But I think he just had it. I think I think what you're getting at, because for me, The Hustler was, again, I saw it too young. I saw it when I was just old enough to start going into places that had pool tables and bars. And yeah. I knew some people that were hustlers, not on the Paul Newman level in this movie or professionals, but my friend used to take his little brother that was 14 and could just school people in pool and pretend and just hustle and make hundreds of dollars. But anyways, back to The Hustler. I kind of felt the same way too. It's a movie for some reason I've never went back to because I've always wanted it to kind of stay as what it was because it launched Paul Newman for me. And that same year he made a movie, 2 years before he made a movie that we have to mention just for historical purposes. Now, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure this is the only place that exists. Look for a movie called Paris Blues, 1958. This is Paul Newman and Sidney Poitier. And,
oh, you told me about that because I didn't see it.
Yeah, and you got to, everyone has to find this movie. And this is not spoiling the movie, but this is the reason why you have to find it. Louis Armstrong, basically just, Paul Newman and Poitier are jazz artists in France, and all of a sudden you hear this trumpet playing, and Louis Armstrong comes in, and he starts playing trumpet and jamming with Newman and Poitier, Mr. Poitier. And the thing that is so great is there's one shot you have to watch for where Newman and Poitier are not in character. They are two, not then, but training to be masters of their craft, and they lose character, and it's them just thinking like, wow, Louis Armstrong is playing jazz to us, and it's the coolest thing to see three American icons, three masters of their craft, three people that you cannot be taught the class that Paul Newman had. You cannot be taught the survival that Mr. Poitier has, and you cannot be taught the music that Louis Armstrong played.
Yeah, just totally awesome to hear that. Like I said, I never saw it, but what you're saying about it, you know, I really am chomping at the bit to find a copy of it.
Oh, it's, you know, I saw it on TCM Rare one night. I call it the movie gods intervened because it was a Sidney Poitier double feature on my birthday. It was my 32nd birthday. It was that birthday we had breakfast with Mac and stuff at my house, and you came over. And
yeah,
they showed The Defiant Ones with Poitier and Tony Curtis, and then this movie called Paris Blues. To me, very few times we break the wall and talk specifically about ourselves, but for me, the movie was interesting because my grandmother's favorite was Louis Armstrong and Sidney Poitier. My mom loves Paris. My other grandma loves the blues. And my dad loved Paul Newman in movies. So to me, this movie was almost like all of your relatives getting together on a film strip.
Yeah, triple header.
Triple header. So with that, we'll go into HUD, which I'll start out with because HUD is kind of a tough one. We do warn you that it does deal with father-son issues. Great performance. I'm going to take a quick look here. I'm really sure because when I looked at Newman's Oscar nods, I want to say one of them is HUD because, yeah, he was nominated for Hustler, HUD, Cool Hand Luke. We're going to get into that as a producer of Rachel. But so it's one of his Oscar nominations. And for me, this shows you the true power of film. I, like anyone, I really get along with my father, but like anyone, have had my disputes with him or spats or times where we didn't get along. And so for me, the film, I'm able to look at stuff and learn from it. And as I've always said,
How did that affect you? Because I know that you've got some deep stuff there.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, at the time, what was interesting was it was when we had, it was around like the time that we had had our first argument. So it was interesting because it was like, I didn't know how long it could go or deep, or there's other people I've met that it's just my dad and I, it's not even bickering compared to what they've went through. So in yeah. some sense, I've been able to learn, and that was a movie that kind of taught me part of it is a rite of passage. I mean, my father, you know, right now is in another state, and he happened to be in a movie lobby and called me the other day, and I was in a movie lobby, and he couldn't figure out what to watch, and we're getting along right now. But it was funny because I was in a movie lobby and he was in a movie lobby, and so it was kind of like, that's why I do this show, because I see that it can have that power. The way I could relate this to HUD is Silver Linings Playbook with Bradley Cooper and De Niro. They have a turbulent relationship, and they do something in the film that my father and I did one time while arguing. And when we watched this movie, I mean, you really could have heard a fly burp.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It was so like, is that how dumb we look? Is that how preposterous we sound? So for all of those out there that tell me, oh, you're so serious, or movies are so serious, it's not that movies are serious. It's that sometimes life is serious.
Yeah.
So with that, I'll just give a quick mention to two films, and then we're going to jump into Cool Hand Luke, which I know most people have seen, but we're getting far enough away from it now to say that there are probably people that have missed it. I want to recommend The Outrage, William Shatner, a very young William Shatner, because we're talking, I think he's in his 80s, and we're talking The Outrage here falls in, oh gosh, where's The Outrage? Anyways, The Outrage falls in whatever. The Outrage is 40 years old, and it's basically a Western version of the Akira Kurosawa film. Okay, sorry, 1964, The Outrage. It's a remake of the Akira Kurosawa film, Rashomon, which if you have not heard Rashomon, finish this podcast and then get to your library tomorrow and grab it, or tell your librarian to order it. One of, I think, five films that have just been given an Oscar. I know The Bicycle Thief didn't compete. It was just given an Oscar. Charlie Chaplin's The Circus was just given an Oscar. This is Rashomon. We could do a whole other podcast about Kurosawa. But please, find The Outrage. Get your pen and paper. Find The Outrage. Not as good as Rashomon, but watch both of them. And then Torn Curtain, which, Jim, you'll be able to talk a little bit here. I'd like you to discuss some. We'll take a couple of minutes here to discuss Mr. Hitchcock, because this is Hitchcock in the 60s. So he's went through his 40s. He's went through owning the 50s. And now he's in the second part of the 60s before what people call his decline. And he did a film called Torn Curtain, which was the only time he worked with Paul Newman. And I'll give you a reference point here of what was going on in Hitch's career around this time. Now, this is a definite decline. This is two films after The Birds, and he has Marnie, Topaz, Frenzy, and Family Plot. I mean, these are known as bad Hitchcock films. And I find it so interesting that Paul Newman, first of all, it speaks volumes to how good of a director Hitchcock was, which we're not going to go into that, that his bad films can get Paul Newman to do it. Paul Newman in Torn Curtain is one to take a look at. Even if you just want to see that film that bridges into Hitchcock's decline, check out Torn Curtain. Now, Jim, I will turn over to you, and I will only mention one thing before I do, that George Kennedy won a well-deserved supporting actor Oscar in another film that, let me just double-check here on the list, is Newman's, it's his fourth Oscar nomination in 1968 for the 1967 classic Cool Hand Luke. Fire away, Jim.
Cool Hand Luke. Yeah, I don't know quite what to say about that. It's that one scene, which is, you know, I mean, if people are into movies or it just happened to see it, the unbreakable will, that scene where he actually, you know, is eating the eggs and being egged on, excuse me, and being, you know, it scrambles. Oh, geez, I can't believe I'm saying that. They can scramble you. It scrambled you as a kid. It was like, how did they do that? You know, I guess it's a little bit naive, and I think maybe I was a bit naive about that. But
right.
it stayed with me. You know, that's one of those
great
iconic scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's no way around it. And that the fact that just by doing that, and just by doing that, that's not the way to say it, actually. But how he was accepted and what a difference that scene. Well, actually, you know, where the scene was happening in the space of the movie really won him the respect of the other prisoners. And again, in that sly sense of humor, even as he was doing that, there seemed to be an awareness, either, I don't know, either as the character or he himself just sort of insinuates that in there in such a way that it does make the scene iconic. Again, something that he could do, this a certain detachment. And I think it really came up in Cool Hand Luke that really added another dimension. And that sense of humor had a detachment. And my feeling is that detachment, that sort of I'm here and I'm going to do it. And I'm going to have fun because it is what I'm doing right now. And in the readings I've done about him, that is a something of who he was in his life, and pulling that up for that part, and being able to put that there in such a way that it added a whole nother, I don't know how to describe it. I don't know what word to use for it, but it added to who he was as an actor and in his life, because I think that reflected his life, that sort of cool detachment. At the same time as being someone who is really dedicated to life, to making movies, to, you know, the stuff we talked about before, the things he got into. And, even the race car driving, you know, later in his life, the things he was involved in an environment as an activist and a philanthropist.
Oh, yes. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, no, it really is reflected in a lot of his movies. And Cool Hand Luke was part of what supported him, my feeling is, just, you know, in being an actor and playing some of the roles that he played. And I think that carried through.
Well, yeah, and that film really is who you see who he is in a documentary. The prankster, the getting along with others, the joy. I was fortunate enough back in 2011, they had a classic film night that was running prints, not Blu-rays projected or DVDs projected, but I saw a print of Cool Hand Luke, and I've also seen a print of Rear Window with Jimmy Stewart, and I've seen a print of Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. But with Paul Newman on the big screen, I definitely understand why we've alluded to it on other podcasts, how girls of any age wanted to watch his old movies, Blue Eyes. He was something else in Cool Hand Luke. And on the big screen, and it's not like we always say, oh, of course the big screen was better. Of course a bigger TV is better. No, this was the spirit made it bigger.
Paul, what I'm going to jump in is one of the things that has happened to him, you know, over years, and like you said, so many people were attracted to those blue eyes, but he pulled it off in a number of movies where it was him without the blue eyes, black and white. And there he was just in the isness of the business.
Right.
And yeah, I'm sorry for interrupting you, but go ahead, please.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, I only mentioned the blue eyes because I laughed because a few episodes ago, Jim told me that I was a straight man who was in love with Paul Newman, and I have to say...
I'm a gay man who's in love with Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah, so it's like, I have to say, if I was going to date a man, it would be Paul Newman in Cool Hand Luke or even Butch and Sundance when he's got that just gruffy look to him. But Cool Hand Luke, you must see. Like I said, I think we're teetering on enough time has passed to where some people haven't seen it. I remember when that was a film that anybody you talked to had seen it, and now people have heard of it and passed it. Let me say one last thing. It is not a chain gang movie. Do not think Jimmy Cagney on a chain gang. Do not think old Warner Brothers mob movies where they go to jail. This is a character-driven piece. It's why George Kennedy got the Oscar and Newman was nominated. That brings us to what I consider to be, of course, after Cool Hand Luke, he made a race car movie called Winning. It's a horrible movie, but race cars ended up becoming his favorite hobby. But to me, the next film we're going to discuss, which I think is the birth of the buddy movie, the movie's now with Ice Cube, Ride Along, Will Ferrell, the cops movie with Wahlberg, Fast and the Furious. The buddy movie, and even Lethal Weapon, which I admire I love the first three Lethal Weapons. I didn't like the fourth. The buddy movie was created with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yeah.
And this is a Western. It won Best Screenplay. William Goldman also wrote All the President's Men. Conrad Hall, who also shot American Beauty and Road to Perdition, which we're going to discuss. That's another Paul Newman movie. But we have a young Robert Redford, who is not Robert Redford, director of Ordinary People, Oscar-winning director, who is not Robert Redford, who runs and started the Sundance Film Festival, which, with no arrogance in our bones, that's where he got the title Sundance, because he was the Sundance kid. So Butch and Sundance, to me, this is just a fun movie. And I remember the last time I saw it was about 2 years ago, and I hadn't seen it in probably 5 years. It is just fun, and it's a Western, and I think that's also why it got the best screenplay, is because it's almost like a completely different film, but in a Western. It's like there's great one-liners. Newman and Redford's chemistry is undeniable. We're going to talk about another film they did called The Sting. But this film, 1969, I just want to give the context of it, and then I want to let Jim go into it because Jim was there for this being new. But 1969, remember, movie fans out there, this is Easy Rider pushing the envelope with drugs and nudity and subversive themes. This is the Wild Bunch pushing violence in cinema. Any violent movie that you see, like, or complain about, you can thank the Wild Bunch and the great Sam Peckinpah, who, on a side note, directed Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid with Kris Kristofferson. 1969 also gives us Midnight Cowboy. The Best Picture winner was X-rated. So you have all that going on, and then out of the blue, you have this dark horse, not dark horse, whatever that saying is. You have this this just buddy movie that's about two guys on the run. Standards are different. All I can say is fun, fun, fun. Watch Butch and Sundance. Jim, you were there in 1969. Take it away.
Okay, well, I'm going to take it away saying, first off, I didn't, and at the time, I did not like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And I'm like, you know, I'm hearing you saying how you liked it, and it was fun, and it was an outlaw movie, and it puzzles me when I look back on it. For some reason, the theme... what was the song? Rain Keeps Falling or something like that.
Yeah,
when they're
rain
on the bike.
Keeps falling on my head. Yep.
Yeah, and I just went, "Yeah," was my response to it. And it didn't matter to me that it was Newman and Redford, who, you know, come on. I love their stuff. Both of their stuff. But, yeah, I just did not like the movie. It grated on me. I was not impressed. Everybody else was. And it was almost like keep your mouth shut. You know?
Interesting.
Yeah, you know, interesting to me. Because
you like Midnight Cowboy? I know you're not big on Easy Rider. And I know you liked, we've never talked about the Wild Bunch, but sorry, go ahead. You weren't into Butch and Sundance.
Yeah, I just wasn't. And it's one of those films you keep saying, you know, if you haven't seen it. Well, I saw it. And I'm going to have to look at it again in some time. Not a big priority because I disliked it that much at the time.
Interesting. Well, you know, it's another thing that stood out for me was that I guess for me also, now that you've mentioned that, because I've actually never met anyone who doesn't like it, is something that kind of stood out too, is there's not gimmicks. There's not relying on the shootout. There's not relying on the kidnapped girl to pull at your emotions. It's just a great different story. And for it to create a genre of movies alone, I think even if you didn't like it, Jim, would be something that I'm sure you've seen buddy movies you liked.
Oh, yeah. No, when you say that, it was the beginning, okay, of that genre, I would definitely thank the movie and that it was made. And I like what came down the line out of that much better.
Oh, interesting, interesting. Well, with that... And you have a little bit more to say about this because it was a book. We both discussed how I've only seen the movie once. Really hard to find. The rumor was Paul Newman had to step in and finish directing it, but it's with Henry Fonda. Sometimes a great notion. All I can say about it is watch it because, A, it's Paul Newman and Henry Fonda together. Secondly, it has one of the most emotional scenes I've ever seen. It's imprinted in my mind when you talk about father and son relationships. They play guys who run lumber up the river, the way if you've ever been in Oregon or anywhere in the mountains and you see trees being dragged down the river. And the ending of the movie is the, honestly, I would say watch the whole movie just to see the last shot. With that, I'll turn it over to Jim, since you had told me, I believe you also read the book.
Yes, yeah, yes, I did. And again, this is something that the book actually stuck with me more than the movie. And, God, look, I can't think of the other... You're going to be much better on this. The man that wrote Sometimes a Great Notion. Do you remember who that was? I mean, it was a Jack Nicholson.
Hold on, I can click on it right here. Ken Kesey, who wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which was obviously Jack Nicholson's big one. But the two Oscars here were nominations were Best Original Song and Best Actor in a Supporting Role. And I guess just real quick, I'll read the synopsis. A family of fiercely independent Oregon loggers struggle to keep the family business alive amidst changing times. Now, before you go into the book, Jim, this would be a really great film to find and rewatch. And I think this almost sounds as relevant as ever because this came out New Year's Eve, 1970. So we are just looking at the 45th anniversary. And we won't get into a political discussion here, but people trying to protect their land from the rich overtaking it. With that, we'll let Jim go into the novel.
Well, okay, I'll go into the novel, and it was, for me, it wasn't as, good Lord, my memory should just set it. The other movie that Ken Kesey did, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Yeah, that stayed with me. Cuckoo's Nest, I think, stayed with me much more than Sometimes a Great Notion. And that was the book and the movie. Even though I liked the book more, the movie didn't quite hit it. And actually, there's not much more I can say on that, which surprises me right now. Right now, I think my mind's doing one of those senior moments where, you know, it just keeps missing the beat.
Well, actually, for those of you out there that don't know, Jim did turn 84 last week.
No, it's 91.
Yes, 91. He actually waited in line for 2 hours to see Chaplin's City Lights.
Smart ass.
Ultimately, the deal is here is that this is the beauty of movies, that you remember certain scenes, you remember certain things that you like or don't like, some things spawn remembering another movie. This is a Martin Scorsese quote, not mine, but I'll repeat it, to where he said the importance of preserving film history is because you don't have to like a movie. You can even hate a movie, but if you like one shot, it was worth it. Or if you learn one tiny thing about yourself, it was worth it. So that's what I see Sometimes a Great Notion as, is that I know if I showed it to you, Jim, again, anybody would get torn over this final scene between Henry Fonda and Paul Newman, two of the best actors who coincidentally, like Newman, Fonda was given an honorary Oscar because he hadn't won, and then won the year after the honorary Oscar. We're going to start talking a little bit more about Oscar because let me do a quick plug here for ourselves. We will be having some Oscar shows. We'll be having a fan and supporter of the show who just knows a heck of a lot about movies and usually sees almost everything during Oscar season. So she'll be hosting some episodes with me. We're hopefully going to get our friend Alexa, who used to work at Turner Classic Movies for 20 years, to come in and help us out with some Oscar trivia. And we'll also be looking at having trying to set up some panels for you guys of filmmakers discussing what they've seen and Oscar movies of the past. So as we get into February, get ready. Come here for your Oscar show. Get it from people who have worked on the films and studied the films. And, that's just something to think about.
Wait a minute, Paul. I love that idea, especially the part of having people who like movies calling in and giving their up to the minute what's happening now with the Oscars. And, you know, who's in them and how the movie affected them, what they thought of it. I like that. Really like that idea.
Oh, yes, because it's two ways. It's the fans and it's the thing. So it's like us, the way we're only able to do a show because we have listeners and the listeners go up and the festivals invite us. Otherwise, we would just be talking in cyberspace. So with that, we go to the 1973 Best Picture, which I only saw once, so I can't speak of, but I can give you the trivia of real quick. It's called The Sting, and it's once again, they paired Newman and Redford. For me, it was not as good as Butch and Sundance, but for Jim, it was better. Many wanted these guys to do films forever, and they both said till the day that Newman died, they had been offered stuff endlessly, and they never found something that they felt wouldn't have tainted their what they did with Butch and Sundance and The Sting. So the 1973 Best Picture is The Sting. And Jim, take it away. What were your thoughts on The Sting?
Okay, as much as I didn't like, the movie I was talking about, with The Sting and the entertainment value of that, for me, I was there, and I was there for the ride, and it was a long movie, and it just, they kept it up. Even if I sort of knew what was coming next, it didn't matter because I was totally entertained. And I can't give it much more of an accolade than that. And it was, the two of them working together and the cast, because it was beautiful. It was fun. I liked it, and it stuck with me.
Well,
the whole premise.
It's the same director as Butch and Sundance, which he won the Best Directing Oscar that year. So they did have a great creative flow. Newman went on to do Slapshot with George Roy Hill. So there was some backing behind that.
Yeah, and that, well, it had a bounce to it.
I'm sorry, you wanted me to remind you of this. We have to tell people to avoid the sequel.
Yeah. Oh God.
All due respect to Jackie Gleason, avoid the sequel. But go ahead, Jim. You were saying it's a good ride.
Yeah, a great ride, and it screeched to a halt with the sequel, which happens a lot of times because that was so iconic and it was such fun. It was good entertainment, and it just was something that stuck with me. As a movie, as entertainment, not looking at some, deeper meaning. Don't have to worry about that. Maybe it says something about me. Big deal. I enjoyed it.
Well, Newman has that theater background, of course. Till the day he died, he would do the Hole in the Wall gang. He would do plays with kids that were ill and young kids. And he always said that was the best part of his career. It wasn't any movies he's made. He said he learned more from acting with 5 to 10-year-old kids than he did with any of the professionals because of that just pure innocence and joy.
Yeah.
And it would be great to get one of those 5 or 10 year olds.
Awesome idea.
Who 10 or 15 years ago did a play with Paul Newman and how it affects them now.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Very good idea.
Yes. So we're going to come back to the Towering Inferno, but Jim, why don't you discuss The Color of Money? And please just give me about 90 seconds to fill up my tea. So The Color of Money, and feel free to go into, it was his Oscar win, but how much you didn't like it. I will be right back. I'm just going to fill up my tea. Like I said, we're always in a coffee shop here. Jim, take it away with Color of Money and your thoughts.
Yeah, like you said, I wasn't really impressed with it. And I know that it was, Tom Cruise was in it, and it's still, even that matchup just didn't make it for me. It was like, okay, The Color of Money, saw it. I had my time in the theater, and Fast Eddie, by taking a pupil, so that sort of turnaround that happens with The Hustler, except that Newman is Jackie Gleason. And, I really don't have a lot to say about that. It was, I'm surprised. I've heard myself say that a few times.
I
love Scorsese, and I'm just, personally surprised that I'm going, there was one I didn't like. There's one that really didn't, impress me, didn't leave an impression, a particular line, a particular scene. It was okay.
Here's a movie that I know, since we're celebrating the holidays, like old movies, we're going to take just a brief intermission here. I apologize for my dry throat, but Jim, I know you can give us 2 minutes about Auntie Mame. Can you do that for our holiday listeners?
Oh, yeah, Auntie Mame, one of my favorite. I show that movie every holiday season. I love going back to it. That was fun. Another one that pure entertainment value. Rosalind Russell. Entertainment for the holidays, and that I could recommend to anybody. In fact, I recommended it to you, Paul. And I don't know if you've seen it yet. I don't think you have. You got that around the holidays for me. But seeing that with your family. That was the big thing for me. It was fun. It was entertaining. It was like what I expected from the guy who wrote it, whose name just Patrick Dennis. That's it. Yeah, Patrick Dennis movie. Total sit back. This is just going to be entertainment. It's going to be fun. It's going to be another type of fun than we get nowadays. It's like, because a lot of the movies I've seen nowadays that are supposed to be funny and entertaining aren't. It's like you don't hear anything from the audience. Okay, I'm supposed to laugh here. With Auntie Mame, I laughed all the way through the movie. And I don't know if I can say much more than that. It's a strong recommendation on my part. For me. Yeah, Paul, what?
Did you watch it this year?
Oddly enough, I didn't. It's just like I'm living in a house with actually two kids, two young kids, my great-nephews and my nephew, and I didn't watch it. That surprises me. I'm talking about it, and here I'm going, every Christmas, but I did it for a number of holidays at the end of the year, a number of times, and always had you're going to do that again, and everybody settles into it and just enjoys it. It's one of those movies for pure enjoyment, I think, has a long shelf life.
Well, that's the beauty of film. As we break up, come back from our intermission, and we're going to head into The Towering Inferno, The Verdict, and Road to Perdition. I want to just take a quick moment here to plug what our next podcast episode is going to be and to make some recommendations to you guys. I got to see on the big screen this Christmas season Star Wars, Joy with Jennifer Lawrence, Bradley Cooper, and Robert De Niro. I got to see The Night Before with Seth Rogen, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Sisters with Tina Fey and Amy Poehler.
You have to see that.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm forgetting the fifth film I saw. Oh, sorry, I did say all five. Creed, Night Before, Joy, Sisters. So the next podcast, which I'll probably be cutting tomorrow, and we're thankful to all of our Canadian buddies from film school and Canadian brothers and supporters who are going to be sending us out to Ottawa and Winnipeg and Toronto and Vancouver, and so officially Talking Pictures will be going east to west and back in Canada and the United States as we do this, as I do this episode. So again, Creed.
Oh, wait a minute, Paul, I really have to jump in on that. Because one of my little picadillos is I love Canadian films. There is just, I think the first one I saw was called Lilies. And out of that, I just sort of was drawn to them. And I really want to keep up. You're really lucky that you went to go to film school up there. I wish I had had an opportunity to do something like that, because I know there's so much that I could get turned on to. We talk about bringing some movie viewers online or on the podcast, and if anybody out there has a recommendation of a Canadian film, I would love it. I know there's...
Yeah, we have an email, paulbrooksmovies@gmail.com. We will keep that, but we'll be changing once we update to our own website. But paulbrooksmovies@gmail.com. Also on Facebook, thank you for bringing this up, Jim. You can check out our Facebook page, Talking Pictures. You'll see a picture of a red carpet and some people on it from a festival down in Florida. You can, and again, please, Talking Pictures on Facebook. We do not do Twitter, but something else we're going to be doing for the show, and we'll jump into The Towering Inferno, is we'll be having reporters at other festivals, Phoenix and Tampa, and stay tuned. You just got to keep listening, and you'll get to see all the cities that we bring to you, just not through Screener, but through our fellow associates checking out festivals. With that, I want to jump into, right after the sting, Newman made The Towering Inferno, which some people call it a Steve McQueen movie. Some people call it a Paul Newman movie. But I want to warn you, definitely do not watch this if you are 9/11 sensitive, but if you lost a loved one in 9/11 or were a firefighter or were in New York, or do not watch this movie. So that's our disclaimer. But for those of you who can still watch those movies, it's not a terrorism movie, but Towering Inferno, part of those disaster films in the 70s, like Earthquake, and there's that volcano one. I believe it was Irwin Allen was the one, and Poseidon Adventure. But Towering Inferno, Steve McQueen is the firefighter, Paul Newman is with the building, and the effects for fire and what they did visually for 1974. I mean, now today is just, you would laugh. It would be like watching a Three Stooges Excuse me. But you always got to put movies in a context, our personal context, our social context, our cultural context. So it was not fun because it's about a burning building, but it was a well-made movie, and I'm sorry, I'm just going to acknowledge it. Cars never drive by the studio, and of course they have to drive by while we're recording. We love you, movie gods, for doing that. But great movie, great performance by Paul Newman, again, and completely different from Butch and Sundance and The Sting, and completely different from the next film we're going to talk about, The Verdict. But Jim, is there anything you'd like to say about The Towering Inferno?
Well, it definitely, again, entertainment, the cast, amazing. How many people were, you know, I mean, anything that has Fred Astaire and Steve McQueen at the same time, that's just a kick. I mean, I think it probably at that time single-handedly kept a lot of people on the payroll. I mean, O.J. Simpson.
O.J. Simpson, Jennifer Jones, Fred Astaire, Faye Dunaway, William Holden, Robert Wagner. Yeah.
Richard Chamberlain. And it was, like you said, you know, nowadays with the special effects, at the time, the special effect was, you know, more than enough to keep me interested. I was in my seat. I was sitting on the edge of it. You know, how is this going to work out? Even though, you know, it's going to end fairly good in this type of movie, it carried it. The suspense was there.
How's this? You're saying keeping you at your seat. It won Best Cinematography. That makes sense. Won Best Film Editing. Best Music. Was nominated for Best Picture. Fred Astaire was nominated for Best Actor. It was nominated for Best Art Direction, Best Sound, and John Williams for Best. John Williams, they're talking about him with Star Wars, and I'll just say this real quick because I don't believe Star Wars deserves any more attention, but he has won 5 Oscars, but he has been nominated for, and in some years he's nominated for 2. So it's 3, 4, 5, 6. In his first 4 years, 2 of the years he's nominated for 2. The next year he's nominated for 2. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. Now that's only by 1989. 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30. 32, I think he has, he's over 40. I think it said he has 51, and if he gets nominated for this Star Wars, it'll be 52. Now, out of all of that, he won for Schindler's List, E.T., Star Wars, and Jaws, and for Fiddler on the Roof. But John Williams, you gotta love him. Sorry, had to mention that, but like you were saying, Jim, I mean, talk about people on the payroll. I mean, even for actors who are past their prime, that's a loaded cast. I mean, this isn't just 70s movie, Faye Dunaway and William Holden still sticking around because we still have Network coming down the pike. And McQueen and Newman are peaking. But with that, since we mentioned Dunaway and Holden, or you mentioned the cast, and that leads to Dunaway and Holden, we can go into Sidney Lumet's The Verdict, 1982, of course, doesn't win Best Picture or Director because Gandhi, doesn't win Best Actor because Ben Kingsley, who, of course, rightfully so, deserved it for playing Gandhi. Great movie. If you need 4 hours to watch it, but it's a great movie. But The Verdict. Jim, do you have anything to say about this? This is the one where Newman plays the drunk lawyer who has to investigate the malpractice suit.
I do have something to say about it. Newman wasn't one to get up on the screen and get into these really, really storm and drong type things, you know, just emoting and, you know, just coming up against it. This is a movie where he goes down into a part of himself and is tortured. He is an alcoholic. And it left such an impression on me that till this day, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a theater or if it's on TV, whatever, courtroom dramas, I'm open to them. There's something there that lingers. And I don't know if the ones I watch nowadays are anywhere near what the verdict was. But it did, you know what a trim tab is on a boat? It's that little piece that, you know, even bigger than the rest of the boat can turn it. And that, for me, that movie and his performance in it has stuck with me. You know, I hate to say it.
No, I mean, there's another reason it's going to stick with you, Jim, because you're such the bookworm. I'm 99% sure. Let me just double check here. And again, we could do a whole half hour on him. But I'm 99% sure that he's credited with the screenplay as well. But if I want to say it's David Mamet, David Mamet wrote the screenplay. So right there, David Mamet is your pre-Aaron Sorkin Mamet, of course, one of the greatest theater, television, film writers, wherever you want to place him. So I'm sure, Jim, that has to do with your love of Mamet, your love of Sidney Lumet. And when you mentioned character, that's a film that they used to have a study in film school, has one of the best ways to introduce a character through what the character is doing. And it's two shots. And again, does not spoil the movie for anyone, but to show you, for those of you that listen to this show, to learn movie techniques, Newman is just sitting at a bar, maybe 9 in the morning, reading the paper, eating a donut, and you immediately think, oh, he must be in a restaurant, he's eating donuts, and then it goes to a kind of a medium wide shot from across the room, and he's in a bar doing shots, eating powdered donuts, looking at the obituaries to try to find clients.
Yeah.
And that right there shows you do not need to say one more word about what kind of person that is.
Yeah.
I mean, that just takes you for, I remember when I came across it, of course, Sidney Lumet, I'm hooked on anything, but at the time I'd seen Dog Days, Serpico, Long Day's Journey Into Night, Network. So my head was kind of just blowing up, and I thought, why is this guy reading the obituaries eating donuts? And so
yeah,
I think
yeah.
You guys gotta check this out. The Verdict, another one with great cast, Jack Warden, who goes back to 12 Angry Men, the guy with the baseball tickets in 12 Angry Men. So yeah, you gotta check out The Verdict. Sidney Lumet, one day Jim and I will do a Sidney Lumet podcast. It'll probably be a three-part, with each part being 90 minutes. And
yeah, well, you know, I'm going to jump in on that. It's like you said, presenting that character, who that character is and how he carries that film. You know, we should do one at some time where it goes back in history, where that character just reappears time after time, pointing up the human condition and how that can play out.
Oh, right.
Yeah, because that has been repeated in so many movies, and probably not as well as in The Verdict, because I can't think of the specific movies at this time. I just know that it's like, yes, yes, yes. It has that same presentation. And probably, if I could remember, there'd be a few that were really good and some that really don't carry it off, like The Verdict did.
Oh, yeah, because that was, I think Lumet's one of the only people you can throw around the word genius with, and it's not like anyone ever goes, no. It's like football. There's no arguing about it. And they just go, yeah, Lumet. In fact, he has a great book called Making Movies. I think I had given you my copy, Jim, last time you were here.
Yes,
oh, no,
I gave
you. And I saw an interview with George Clooney on Inside the Actors Studio, and they said when he directed his first, like, serious film, Good Night, Good Luck, they said, what'd you do to prepare, given that you've worked with the Coens and Soderbergh? And he said, well, the first thing I did was I read Sidney Lumet's Making Movies. Now, what's interesting about this is Sidney Lumet made movies from 1957 till when he died in 2007 or 8. He was 84, and he came out of television. And Sidney Lumet, this book is small. And I think that's why he was such an effective director, because his shot was, all we need to do is see him reading the obituaries and show him in a bar, and that tells you that he's a deadbeat. We don't need to have a child support scene, and he's fired, and he doesn't have money for his bill. So Sidney Lumet's Making Movies. I want to just throw out one last thing for you people, the listeners who listen to this to learn about movies. George Clooney said that Sidney Lumet used to walk on the set and print the very first take, which now we're shooting on digital, so they don't say print, but he'd say print. And Sidney Lumet said that was to make the crew think that at any moment you better be ready to move on to the next thing. And so that was a great tip that he gave that George Clooney shared with the master's class. So Sidney Lumet, his films, and of course worked with every actor known, worked with every, got one, helped many actors get nominations or win Oscars. Genius of a filmmaker. I think the only reason why we haven't done a podcast about him yet is because I would be talking and Jim would just hang up the phone. With that leads us right into our last film that we're going to discuss when we talk about great directors and how not all great directors can continue it. Sam Mendes has, but not to Sidney Lumet's level, but Road to Perdition. Now, this was Tom Hanks and Paul Newman. Newman's got a supporting actor Oscar nomination for this, his last Oscar nomination. This is before he did his final TV movie and then started doing voices and doing stuff with his kids' charities. But Road to Perdition, Best Cinematography Oscar. Same cinematographer as American Beauty, same director as American Beauty. So there was this it wasn't quite Star Wars hype, but it was as art house hype as you could get following up American Beauty. So Road to Perdition.
Yeah.
Jim, tell us what you thought.
Well, one of those movies, hard. Definitely pointing up having that outsider type mentality in it, some really, really dark, like you said, the cinematography, but also the storyline, the acting. The thing that runs it is when the jealousy, good old fashioned jealousy, and how scary it can be. I mean,
right.
It had that, like you said, art house almost, because of, the darkness of it. I don't want to say all, art house movies are dark, but this really does hit the mark as far as the darkness of it goes. And I think I appreciated that more, further down the line with, I know we're using Newman as a, to follow this this arc, but this one takes a ride into perdition, if not perdition, purgatory, if not purgatory, hell.
Right.
And I
right.
Yeah. And the list of actors, again, it's like Tom Hanks, Jude Law, you know, Jennifer Jason Lee, and Paul Newman. It's like, it took a cast like that to pull it off. Whoever did the casting, they should definitely be taken out to lunch, if not dinner, get a big pat on the back.
Oh, right. I mean, it was great to have Newman and Hanks because there's small moments, even though they're adversaries, there's small moments I love because I think it's harder to point out for non-obsessed movie people, for people who take movies as the icing on the cake and don't dig into the cake. But I love when no matter how good the actor is, you can tell that they are thinking, I'm in front of the camera with Paul Newman. And there's moments with Tom Hanks where he is just so in the zone of passion or his A game that it's not about I got to earn my money. It's not about I got to entertain my crowd. It's not his ego. It's just, wow, he's getting up there in age, and I'm getting the chance to be put on film here. And it is a dark film, definitely why it won the Oscar. The use of shadows is amazing. The scene in the rain, which we won't talk about because it spoiled the film. The back and forth, the twists and turns, again, Jude Law. What the final scenes is one of the great final scenes in cinema. Again, Road to Perdition after American Beauty, but same director, same cinematographer. So please, please, we beg of you, do not try to compare the two. Do not think you will have as much life change as American Beauty. I get so frustrated with audiences when they expect a director to pull off American Beauty with something that's nothing like American Beauty. But Road to Perdition, I think I feel the same way as Jim. The first time I saw it, I actually didn't like it because I was caught up in the American Beauty hype. And then the first time I saw it on VHS, I loved it. And I saw it again on DVD. And every time I see it at the library, I'll grab it and I'll discover something new. The great Conrad Hall, whose Oscars are Butch and Sundance, American Beauty, and Road to Perdition. And now there's a Conrad Hall Jr., so please don't get them mixed up. Conrad Hall died. Actually, the year he won for Road to Perdition, his son had to receive his Oscar, get his Oscar for him. So,
I want to jump in real quick. This movie seemed like the type of movie, like, you know, with the actors that they have here. Like I said, Jude Law, Paul Newman, Tom Hanks. This is the type of thing that my feeling is, and I've never heard an interview where they talked about it, but, you know, that they were probably really sort of pumped up to get to jump into these characters and, you know, go into that just because it did have a depth and a width to it.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, I mean, this movie had a lot more than just the cast and the story or the Newman allure. I mean, it really was, let's face it, we live in a marketing world. It was going to get the American Beauty. What's the director doing next? I mean, no, not taking anything away from Sam Mendes. He's made great films like Jarhead and Revolutionary Road with Kate Winslet, his wife, and DiCaprio. And he's a great filmmaker. He actually directed Skyfall, the last James Bond movie. Not Spectre, the one that's out. So he is a great, diverse director, but that was like the emergence. And again, that was an interesting time in film, too, because you had Alexander Payne or David Fincher coming out, and you had Paul Thomas Anderson, and you had that mini revolution of strong voices. So it was kind of like the 70s, the changing of the guard. Paul Newman's passing on, and actors like Tom Hanks are taking it over, and younger guys like Mark Wahlberg, and we won't get into it. We will one day do a Philip Seymour Hoffman podcast, rest in peace. We're both still upset of what happened to him. Such a talent. Anyone out there, if you said Philip Seymour Hoffman, who, please, I give you permission to turn us off right now and Google him and watch every movie he was ever in. It's definitely going to do more for you than hearing my voice right now. But we dedicate this show, this show in general, it is because of artists like Philip Seymour Hoffman, who gave us so many great movies to discuss and watch and go back to and share with friends and throw on at a party. And with that, I'm going to do one last plug of what's coming up for us, and then I'll let Jim do his sign off, and then I'll wrap it. But again, we're going to be having panels. Oscar month, we'll definitely have some special guests. We might even be able to schedule, we've been just trying to find the right time for a few Oscar nominees and winners. We'll be bringing in more film fatales. The wonderful group who've given us 5 great guests. We'll be having panels, and we'll be having film talk sessions, and we'll just be discussing more of the business, as well as, please, go into the archives. If you're listening to this through Facebook, go to our Talking Pictures page. If you're listening to this just from a link someone sent you, please go to the main site, www.blogtalkradio.com. All one word, blogtalkradio.com/Paul Booth Movies. This is our 51st episode, so you'll get stuff with directors, historians, us just talking about remakes. This episode right here, Jim and I usually pick films or a director or an actor. We also did a 2-part Elizabeth Taylor episode, and we just dive into it. So we hope to build audiences for each one of them. We cover major film festivals too. So please tell your friends, if they're not into Paul Newman or Elizabeth Taylor, then tell them they can check out the reviews of what's out right now, or they can check out what film festivals in their area. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jim for his sign off.
Okay, well, I am excited about some of the twists we're going to be doing and what we're presenting. And, I'm an old futz, and it actually gets the blood moving. I'm looking forward to it. And I hope that as Paul sort of delineates what we have coming down the road, that, be open to just something new coming from us. We don't want to get stuck in this one way of doing this. And, let us know.
Yes. Bill, this show really is for you guys. If we wanted to tape ourselves and just listen to ourselves, we would. So, again, paulboothmovies@gmail.com, or like us on Facebook. Feel free to leave a message on there. We're going to start doing random picking. You post a movie on Facebook that you want reviewed, and we'll review it on the show. If you want to be Joe from West Virginia, we won't give out private names or information. We want this to be because ultimately we're both also inspired by how radio used to be and how music, you didn't know what was coming. The same song didn't play every day at 5 o'clock. So to us, this is also a rock and roll channel for movies. Anything goes, no limits, no laws. My sign-off's going to be just guests that come on can't use the N-word. and don't use it in your post, don't use it anyways. I want to say thank you for joining us for our 51st episode, our first of 2016. I send a thank you from our producer, Rob Starrett, our sound man, Wayne, our executive producer, Carolyn Booth. We still dedicate the next couple episodes to our marketing girl, Michi, rest in peace, who took us international. And that's all for me. Any final words, Jim?
I'm pumped, and I hope other people are. Please join in. It's the more we have people joining in, and I don't mean just listening to us, but when we have the ability to have people call and talk, that's icing on the cake. That's all.
Yes. Yes. Oh, perfect. And I'm going to just add to that, Jim, that here is a place, and tell all your friends, here is a place. I tell every guest, I tell everyone. One more thing we're going to do. We're going to be having someone comes on who reviews sports films, someone who comes on and reviews cultural films, someone who comes on and reviews their favorite genre. But there is no ego here. There is no attitude here. And we let everyone know. What?
Hey, wait a minute, Paul. I've got ego and attitude, so it comes through.
Oh, yeah, you're such an egomaniac. So we want you to know that this is a place where it's not going to be, oh, you haven't seen this, so come back when you have. This is just one prerequisite. If you love movies, join us. That's it for me. Aloha and welcome to the year 2016.
Okay, and aloha for me too.
Take care, everyone, and make sure whatever you do tonight, have a great time, but make sure and watch a good movie.